Welcome back, everyone, to another week of True Crime on Easy Street. I'm Katie Givens. I'm still not a lawyer.
Scott Wright, I am a mediocre journalist.
Kelly Turner, not a doctor.
It's nice that Katie was happy enough to come back to her office today and turn on all the equipment that you and I don't know how to use unless she is here. She's been away on a boat for the last week with her family, and we didn't record last week. We recorded two episodes the week before that so that she could go on her boat escapade.
Thanks, I don't know how guys.
Much you want to talk about it?
Oh, we had a great time. We were
in the Caribbean on a big, huge boat.
We were. We did Mexico and Royal Caribbean's little private island situation.
Was there was this the boat where there's a go-kart track on the boat?
No go-kart track.
Okay, because there is one.
Yeah, that's there was.
That's there is wow.
Yeah. Ice skating. Okay. Ziplining.
Zipline.
Mini golf. Surfing. It was a big boat.
How many golf balls did Shane drive into the ocean at the mini golf course?
Zero.
Well, much less than I thought it was going to be. Yeah. So good. He's making progress with his short game. That's always nice to hear.
You know, he does not golf at all. He always got the short game because all we do is mini golf.
And don't go too far down the road on his short game. He gets a little sensitive about that.
I wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Well, he will if he ever listens. And
he's
probably
not going to listen. It's fine.
Good. So we don't have to cut that. Yeah. Before we get started, I did get we're not really doing shout outs, I guess, but I did hear from a friend of the show, Cade Gossett, over the weekend because he texted me yesterday and he was listening to our fourth and final Murdoch case. And if you guys will recall, we pondered the thought whether or not Buster Murdoch might show up at Cade's bachelor party. Cade assured me yesterday in a text message that he did not, but wished that he had, because what a great story that would have been to tell.
No Buster, huh? There.
No Buster.
Okay.
So well, thanks for keeping us informed, Cade.
We have a very nice 5-star rating and very nice comment.
Do tell.
Connie Geimer, we've given her a shout out before.
Yeah. We've given her a t-shirt before.
But she says, can't say enough good things about you guys. This makes my Wednesday mornings. Thank you, Connie.
Happy
Wednesday morning to you.
For Connie and the other 5 people whose Wednesday mornings are made by our weekly contributions to the world of podcasting, we certainly do appreciate you taking the time to let us know.
Good morning. And let's all just, you know, raise our coffee cups and say cheers this morning.
Cheers.
As we drive to work, or we're already at work, or whatever we're doing.
You're speaking in the future as if it is Wednesday morning.
That's when this episode will drop.
I have a coffee cup in my hands.
Actually, she does. I shudder to think what's in it, but Katie does have a coffee cup in her
hand. I have another cup in my hand. It does not
I know what's...
does not have coffee.
I know that's not coffee. And I know what they serve over at Easy Street, as do you guys, and I just had 3 of those before I came over here, so we're all lubricated. In our own particular way, whatever that is.
I think that's inappropriate, Scott. If you're just
sorry.
Oh boy.
I'm just kidding.
My bad.
Oh no. So this week, I came into this no knowledge whatsoever. But
that's not true.
What you told me was you were going to tackle the O.J. Simpson case, and I gave the same noise that everybody collectively gives.
Yeah, you did.
When they hear about O.J., because it's been overdone so many times. But when you said, I'm going to take a different angle, and you told me, I was intrigued, and so I'm intrigued today. I'm excited to get to this episode today.
Dumb as you ever were about the O.J. case, by your own admission.
Yes.
But excited to see how we tackle this from a different angle.
Yes.
Instead of doing the whole thing and dragging it out and make it a 3 or 4 part series, we're going to cram all of this shit into an hour.
Cram it.
Cramming beginning now. So what I decided that I would do is, are we forgetting anything? Do we have anything else that we need to do? Oh, there's one other thing we need to do. There's a Casey White update. Just briefly.
Okay.
There's been some legal wranglings over in Lauderdale County, up in Lauderdale County. Katie, you may have to walk me through the short version of this, but they're doing hearings and they're trying to decide if there's going to be a change of venue. And everything that we said 2 weeks ago on this show about, especially what Katie said, has turned out to be the exact truth, because they are going to, the defense argument is going to be in the escape case that Casey White had no idea what was going on, that Vicky White was the mastermind of this entire plan. And you know what, guys? I'm not so sure that argument's not going to stick, because
Well, Vicky's not here to defend herself, so.
That's one thing. And the other thing is every piece of footage that we have is him in shackles being led into the back of that patrol car. And we don't know what happened in the 11 days that they were gone. We know that Vicky White bought a bunch of weapons and sold her house and had cash and bought getaway cars. I think it's a pretty compelling argument that he was just along for the ride. And I'm curious to see how that plays out in court. But that is a new development in the Casey White / Vicky White case that we, of course, will keep you guys posted on.
Oh, and we'll definitely do an update episode once all of this transpires. I don't know how long it's going to take, but
it's going to take a while.
It's going to be something to see and something to pay attention to. Also, we posted on our social media, was it a week ago? A couple weeks ago, I guess. When you sent that to me about the Murdoch housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield's body.
Being exhumed.
Yeah, exhuming her body. And there's an update there. And
crazy.
We'll let you know.
Yeah. We're staying on top of those cases because a lot of the cases that we talk about are already done. They're ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
But recently we've done those two cases, the Murdochs and the Whites, and ongoing cases. So whatever we can do to keep you posted, we will half-ass it as best we can. I'm a mediocre journalist. What do you expect? Yeah. All right. So let's get to the O.J. Simpson case. And what I decided to do, with your blessing, both of you, is to tackle this from a little bit different direction. We're going to talk about the 10 facts we've all forgotten about the O.J. case. And not necessarily in any particular order. It's not like number 10 is much less compelling than number 1, but I try to kind of take them chronologically. This top 10 list is going to sort of walk us through the case itself. If I do it correctly, you guys and our listeners will let us know if I do not.
I understand what you're saying. You're going with time. So
it's a timeline.
Number
of top
one
10
is
things.
Not going to be like the most outrageous thing that you forgot.
No, that's like 4.
It's just going to.
Yeah, that's like number 4.
Okay. Well,
but in the timeline, that's where it drops. And your opinion about whether or not that's worthy of being number 4 may differ from mine.
Well,
it depends on how big of a fan of Saturday Night Live you are.
I like Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay. Well, do we start with number 10? I mean, like a number 10 or
sort of? I'm going to give a brief synopsis of the case for all of you young folks out there who don't remember exactly what happened on June the 12th, 1994, which was a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting in this office right now on Monday, June the 13th. So 28 years ago.
How about that?
The timeline, the days of the week were exactly the same as they are in 2022.
How about that?
So on Sunday night, June the 12th, 1994, Nicole Brown and her friend Ron Goldman were murdered in front of the steps of her condominium on Bundy Drive in the Brentwood area of Los Angeles. You can look up the crime scene photos for yourself. I did. They're gruesome. The autopsy photos are even worse. You do your own research there.
Not to be brutal, but her head was almost completely
cut off. She was
almost
decapitated. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that you'll read over and over and over, that he was. Mm-hmm. She was almost decapitated. She had a total of 7 wounds on her body. Ron Goldman, 27.
Wow. So are these stab wounds?
For him, yes. Well, both of their necks were.
Were slit.
Slashed.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But Ron, especially, he knew karate, or maybe it was taekwondo. So the speculation is that he tried to defend himself in the last moments of his life because he had some defensive wounds on his hands and his feet. And, he went down swinging, literally. But he did go down. And so 2 dead bodies in front of her condominium on June the 12th, 1994. 5 days later is the big Bronco chase. I'm going to get to that. That's on the list. The case drags out until the following October. It's October of 95 before. And if you don't know by now, I'm not spoiling it for you. It's not too soon to tell you that OJ is not found guilty in the murder, in the criminal
case. In the criminal case, right.
We'll get to the civil case as well.
OJ is Nicole's ex-husband.
OJ Simpson, former football star, Heisman Trophy winner, TV personality, movie star, very quickly becomes the number one suspect in this crime.
Mm-hmm.
By the next day, the cops are looking for him. I'm sorry, it's not the next day. By Friday, June the 17th, 1994, the cops are looking for him, and that is the day that he jumps into a white Ford Bronco and takes the police on a 2-hour-long car chase through the interstates of California.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll give you a few more details as we go along. But that's basically it in a nutshell. Two people murdered. O.J. Simpson is the number one suspect. The trial ensues. He's found not guilty in the criminal trial. Mm-hmm. That gets us to the number 10 thing on the list. And again, it's sort of a chronological thing that I'm attempting to do here. You guys will let me know how I do with this. But one of the things that people don't realize or maybe have forgotten about the OJ case is that there was a brand new vocabulary that suddenly became a part of the national consciousness. I'm just going to give you a few of them. Brentwood, Bundy Drive, Cato Kalin, Bruno Magli. Did I say that right? The Italian shoe brand, Bruno Magli. It's M-A-G-L-I, or is that a silent G in Italian? Mali.
I don't remember. Mali is how you actually kind of say. And that was what terrible, but said. It's like, it makes a different noise.
Exactly. Yeah. And then there's the Kardashians, for Pete's sake. Nobody had ever heard of the Kardashians in June of 1994. And now we can't get them out of our damned ears or off our TV screens or anywhere else. But back then, nobody had ever heard of them.
Right.
And I think the most common phrase that we all have heard since then that we can still say now, slow speed car chase. That's something, just a few of the examples of the vocabulary that the OJ case brought into the world that did not exist before. So that's number 10. We're done with 10.
Okay.
Number 9, speaking of the Bronco chase, that took place, like I mentioned a moment ago, on Friday, June the 17th, 1994. It was a slow speed car chase. And what happened that morning was that the LAPD and the district attorney's office had let Robert Shapiro, who was OJ's lead attorney, mm-hmm. know that he was being charged with the murders. There was an arrest warrant out for him, and he was expected to show himself at Parker Center, where LAPD headquarters are in downtown LA, by a certain time that morning.
Okay. Turn yourself in.
Turn yourself in. It's time to come and face the music. Mm-hmm. We got you. At least that was what they thought at the time. And what happens is he sneaks out of his house while his lawyers are downstairs trying to figure out how to coordinate this response to the police department and the DA and the arrest warrant. He and his friend Al Cowlings, who had played college football together at USC and later played together at the Buffalo Bills, sneak out of the house and get into AC's white Bronco. Now, there's a white Bronco that OJ owns at the time that has already been impounded by the LAPD because that thing has bloodstains in it. And that was one thing that Katie and I talked about. She didn't realize that it was a different Ford Bronco or that anybody other than OJ was driving the car. And a lot of people did. That's why I put it on the list.
Well, I knew that OJ was not driving, but I didn't know it was not his
vehicle. It's not that one. Okay. That one has been impounded because there's blood evidence in it.
Oh.
But the Hertz Rental Car Corporation owned that. They owned OJ's Bronco and they also owned AC's Bronco because they're best friends. And if OJ gets a free Bronco from Hertz because he's a spokesman for the Hertz Rental Car Corporation at the time, he finagled a deal where his buddy AC got one as well. Okay. Identical cars.
Okay.
So they sneak out of the house, jump into AC's white Ford Bronco and drive south on I-5 to go down to see Nicole's gravesite. That's the story that they tell later. They drive down. They want to drive about an hour south of OJ's home in Brentwood because he knows he's about to turn himself in and he wants to see her gravesite one last time. Again, this is a story that is told later.
He's so devoted.
He's very devoted. And so they get down there and they realize that the place has been staked out by the police. And so they turn around and head back. And that's when the press conference from the LAPD takes place. The APB is put out for the white Bronco with AC and OJ inside. Mm-hmm. And that's at about 6:30 local time, Pacific time, in California on Friday, June the 14th, 1994. And I still remember exactly where I was when all of that hit the fan because we ordered pizza. There was a shortage of pizza that night in the country.
Were you in college during this?
I had just graduated, but I still lived in Tuscaloosa with my buddies. I was still living the college life and working a job, but basically we had nothing to do, especially on a Friday. Mm-hmm. So we ordered beer and pizza and sat in front of the TV for the next 2 hours, and like most of the rest of the country. 95 million people watched some portion of the slow speed car chase on that Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. That was 5 million more people than watched the Super Bowl that had taken place back in January.
Really?
Yes.
It doesn't surprise me.
It was that big of a deal. Everybody was doing it. Every bar in the country was empty unless they were already there drinking beer and eating pizza at their bar of choice because we stayed in my friend David's apartment all night and watched the whole thing.
Every news outlet cut to it.
Yes, there was an NBA playoff game happening on, I guess it was NBC because it was Bob Costas, and they cut into the NBA finals to broadcast the helicopter shots of the slow speed car chase
car
up
kind
the 405
around,
back to Brentwood because AC had called on the 911. He called 911 and said, look, OJ's got a gun to his head. Everybody leave us alone. I'm just trying to bring him back home. He wants to talk to his mother and then he will turn himself in. Which ended up being what happened without going into all of the details. Mm-hmm. It took some time. It was about 8 o'clock local time in California when he finally turned himself in. And that was 10 o'clock here in the central time zone.
Which was
and 11 on the East Coast.
How many hours late?
He was supposed to turn himself in at 11 a.m. So call it 9 hours.
Okay.
Yeah, I have done no individual research of this case because I wanted to be wild with the audience. Because you know, I wasn't even 1 year old when this happened.
That's true.
So I didn't get to sit in a bar and watch it.
I didn't sit in a bar because I was in high school, but
yeah.
But I did
or
watch
sit
it.
Or sit my
yeah.
I did watch it.
Well, it was what we did that night.
It was a big.
I remember
deal.
It. I remember and walking into David's apartment and he was like, "Hey, pull up a chair. You got to see this because it had happened. It started."
Okay, so fun fact. I didn't know this at the time because I did not know my husband Kevin at this.
Does
time.
Anybody really know Kevin?
he's you know. Yeah, he's such an anomaly. It's hard
to I wish you listened to the show so we could hear that. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
But I believe he said, had just purchased a white Bronco that looked just like that vehicle. I want to say maybe a week before or 2 weeks before
that's
this happened.
Hilarious.
But a very stylish vehicle.
A very stylish vehicle. He still had the vehicle when we started dating.
Oh, if he still had that vehicle.
But he doesn't have it to this day, but he had not had that vehicle very long, and it was exactly the same vehicle.
That is funny.
Yeah.
All right. So that gets us to number 8 on our top 10 list. And again, this is sort of a timeline progression. Mm-hmm. So we've got OJ in custody. The trial, there's a lot of motions. By the time this case was over, the defense had filed 393 legal motions. Their defense strategy, and I'll get to that in number 6, I think. Their defense strategy was to dispute every single thing, to tie it up in the courts as long as they could and drag it out and dissect the case one tiny little bit at a time, not to mention throw race right into the middle of it. But I'll get to that. But on the other side of the table, prosecutors Marcia Clark and Chris Darden were very confident in the evidence. There was a lot of DNA evidence on the scene. There were eyewitnesses who could put certain people at certain places at certain times, including a lady named Jill Shively, Shivley, and she was driving her car at 10:45. And the prosecution's argument is that the murders took place between 10:15 and 10:30 on that Sunday evening. Without getting into all the details about who ended up where and how they all got to where they were supposed to be at that time. But a lady named Jill Shively was trying to get to a local restaurant before it closed at 11, and she got to a red light intersection in the Bundy Drive area of Brentwood when a white Bronco came blasting through against the red light, almost caused an accident, rolled down his window, yelled at her, and she immediately recognized that person as O.J. Simpson in a mad panic to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that nobody in court, nobody in the courtroom, none of the jurors ever heard about Jill Shively was because Marcia Clark said, listen, don't go tell anybody this story. We want you to appear before the grand jury and tell what you saw. Well, the grand jury met on Tuesday the following week. So that would have been the 21st of June. Okay. So on the 20th of June, she goes to a Hollywood studio and sits down with the folks at Hard Copy. And back then in the early 90s,
I remember Hard Copy.
Back then in the early 90s, those shows were, they were a pandemic on television.
Did Hard Copy come on like before The Simpsons or right before some show?
All those true crime shows. You had Hard Copy. You had Inside Edition.
Maybe it's Inside Edition.
You had Court TV had become a thing. We'll get to Court TV in a minute. But this was the first ever case that really just enthralled the entire country. Everybody sat in front of their TV for months and months at a time, or at least saw the day's events recapped on the evening news, because that was something that happened every single day. But anyway, so Jill Shively, she takes about $6,000 from the folks at Hard Copy to tell her story. Okay. Knowing that it's not going to be told until after she speaks to the grand jury, she thinks she's in the clear. She thinks she hasn't violated anyone's trust.
Wow.
But when Marcia Clark finds out about it the next day, she says, look, I don't even want you to testify. We've got all of these great witnesses. We don't need you. We don't want anybody. It was all brand new. Nobody really knew how to deal with hard copy and these other news. And I'm doing news in air quotes.
So she just said, Marcia just said, we're just not going to deal with it.
See you, bye, Jill. Don't need you. I don't want
to. Take your $6,000.
Corrupt my evidence by you having made money off of what you supposedly saw.
Mm-hmm.
That taints your story as far as I'm concerned. I'm trying to prosecute somebody for murder, so you're out.
Okay.
First of many mistakes that the prosecution made. And so, again.
Can you blame Marcia, though, for that? I mean, with it being such unknown territory.
It was brand new, uncharted territory.
And you're thinking that the defense is just going to pick that apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they would have.
And they probably would have.
Yeah.
They would have because, yeah, we're going to get to the defense team.
I just don't know that I'm going to blame Marcia too much for that particular decision.
There were a lot of things that, you know, hindsight being 50-50 and all, as Pat Dye once said. No, Pat Dye said that one time, Auburn fan. We can fight that out in the parking lot after.
That's okay.
But I mean, this is 94 in Los Angeles, and the district attorney's office in LA has already screwed up the Menendez brothers case. They've already screwed up the McMartin preschool case. They've already screwed up the Twilight Zone murder case, the Twilight Zone death case where actors were killed on the set of Twilight Zone, the movie, Vic Morrow being one of them, and the Rodney King beating where they had video evidence of everything that happened on the street to Rodney King and four white police officers still walked. So the LA District Attorney's Office has, everybody thinks these clowns are going to fuck it up again. And here we are 28 years later.
And he wasn't found guilty.
Make up your own mind how that worked out. So that gets us to number 7 on my top 10 list. And that gets us to the dream team of attorneys that O.J. Simpson was able to bring together to defend him in this case. And we have Robert Shapiro, who has been in L.A. and defended famous people before in his career. We have F. Lee Bailey, who is the guy who got Sam Shepard off. And if you have ever seen the movie The Fugitive, that's based on a true story. And F. Lee Bailey was the person who got Dr. Sam Shepard off for allegedly murdering his wife. I don't know if they ever found the one-armed man, but F. Lee Bailey had a huge reputation as someone, as a very keen and capable defense attorney who was great at cross-examination and details and pointing the blame at someone other than his own client. And so he's on the team. Johnny Cochran, a civil litigator, civil rights, as well as just civil cases. He had a lot of experience in that area. And he was the African-American. He was the black man on the team. And that becomes important in this case. And then, of course, you had Alan Dershowitz. You had Barry Scheck, who was a DNA expert. So really some of the most famous and well-rounded defense attorneys, criminal defense attorneys in the country, they all come to L.A. at Bob Shapiro's request. Because they just want to be, these are the guys who they make their reputation by defending this kind of client.
And the Kardashian man was a friend.
Bob Kardashian was he'd been OJ's friend for 30 years and he did have a law degree, but he'd been in business.
Okay.
But when OJ got into trouble, he reactivated his law license and he was pretty much there. He was kind of OJ's cheerleader. He didn't really do anything as far as the case itself. He was just kind of the conduit between the other legal minds and OJ.
Well, and he had personally known OJ
30 years.
So many years.
Yes.
So that, I could see that.
He was a calming force in that room when they all sat around and talked about defense strategy, I can imagine. OJ, listen to what they're saying. OJ, you should do this. OJ, I don't think you should do that.
And
that sort of presence.
OJ trusted him.
He did.
When he would say these things.
He doesn't know any of these other guys, but he'll listen to Bob Kardashian.
Gotcha.
So that's kind of how that worked out. So you've got this fantastic defense team. And listen, no tactic was too egregious for this defense team. I'm going to give you one example before we move on to number 6. Before the jury, when the jury was finally seated and the case began, one of the things that the jury did was they hopped on a bus and they went to both the Nicole's condo, the crime scene at 875 South Bundy, and they also went to 630 Rockingham, which is where OJ's house was. But before they got to OJ's house, the defense team redecorated the whole place.
Yes. I actually remember this. I did remember this.
They put in a lot more football memorabilia. They put in a lot of things that made him seem like he was closer to his African American heritage than he actually was.
Mm-hmm. They staged his house.
Yes. They took down some pictures of his girlfriend in her bathing suit and put up pictures of his mother, like dressed for Mother's Day kind of thing.
Very wholesome.
Yes.
A lot more wholesome than his house appeared.
Yes.
In the days before that. So that's just one of the things that they did.
I mean, call it what it... They staged his house.
They staged it.
They didn't
Why would you
change
it? Anything
they staged it.
If you're not staging it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's obviously
so
what
So when the jury
doing.
Came in to see it, there it was. They did not change anything about Nicole's house.
Nicole's house had already been cleared out mm-hmm. because it had been months at this
point.
So
it did not look like a human being even really
Yeah, there was no furniture. There was nothing on the walls.
They dehumanized her.
Yes. Well,
and, yeah.
I mean, that was just the circumstances of the way that the condo, I mean, after she died and the landowner or the property owner, I guess, had the place cleaned up after the police released it as a crime scene and he had it ready for the next tenant to move in or at least to show to a prospective tenant.
It makes no sense why they even visited this place.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah. Then why even go?
Yeah. The
So they could go see his house.
The 2016 Netflix series, The People versus O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story is very well done. It's a 10-part series, I think. So if you want to learn some more about the details of this case, it follows very closely the book, The Run of His Life, The People versus O.J. Simpson by Jeffrey Toobin, who is an attorney himself turned journalist. And he kind of interjects himself into the case a little bit, not directly, but he is there covering the case. Jeffrey Toobin, the author is. He's there every day in the courtroom. And so sometimes he will say, I observed this happening or I overheard this happening. And that's the extent to his interjection of his own predispositions into the case. But it's a really good book. And the documentary series follows it pretty closely. So if you're interested, those are two places that I looked for information that you might want to do the same.
Okay.
That gets us to number six. We're almost halfway through this thing, guys. Hang on. If you have to pee, just hit pause. We'll be here when you get back. So number six, there's a lot of speculation, or I don't guess it's really even any speculation. The courtroom became a performance hall in many respects. Everybody knew that the court TV had one camera over on one wall, and there was somebody who's charged every day with working a little remote control device to zoom it in here and pan it over there. But there was only the one camera in the courtroom. But I remember coming home from Tuscaloosa to visit my parents on the weekend at the time, and mom always had court TV on. I would have watched nothing but the OJ trial, even if I didn't want to, because on the weekends they would just rehash, they'd have the highlight shows going on, and that's all we watched. If I turned it and she was in the shower, she would hear the channel change and stick her head out with her hair bonnet on, wrapped up in a towel, and they turn that back. It was nuts. So
she was invested
big time. And so the courtroom became sort of a performance hall. And Judge Lance Ito, according to a lot of people, was responsible for a lot of that. In fact, at one point, Marcia Clark called him a star fucker. That's a direct quote from Jeffrey Toobin's book. He overheard her say that in some moment of disgust with some decision that Lance Ito had made about what was going to happen next in the courtroom. I'll give you one example about what Ito did. One day he held court for 30 minutes after it was supposed to begin because he was entertaining CNN's Larry King in his chambers. He was just hanging out, having a conversation with Larry King to the point where, according to Jeffrey Toobin, Larry King said, hey, don't you need to get back out to the courtroom? And so at that point, Ito brings Larry King into the courtroom through his private door. And before the case goes back in front of the jury, I guess the jury's not in the room just yet, Larry King goes over and says hi to Bob Shapiro and F. Lee Bailey. He knows all these guys for years because he's interviewed them 100 times. Mm-hmm. I think F. Lee Bailey was involved in the something to do with the Charles Manson case at some point. He defended somebody that was involved with Manson. And then, of course, Sam Shepard, he's talking to Johnny Cochran. And finally, the woman who is in charge of public relations for the prosecutor's office realizes that all of this is being broadcast on court TV. So she runs over and grabs Larry King and brings him over so that he can meet Marcia Clark and Chris Darden, the defense's black person on the prosecution team. And just so that the books are sort of in balance, like at least you've met both sides.
What a circus.
It was a circus. It was a straight up circus. So that's just one of the examples. I could give you dozens, but I mean, it was a shit show.
Yeah.
If you watched it, if you remember anything about it, mm-hmm. and you can go on YouTube right now, and there's a great documentary called OJ 25. It's a documentary series on YouTube. It was broadcast live on Court TV just a couple of years ago, and they break down the court case. It's the 25-year anniversary at the time, and they break down the court case 1 week at a time, and every episode is what happened that week mm-hmm. in the courtroom, and they jumble up some of them. They cram some of them together because overall, the court case lasted 37 weeks, so they couldn't run it for 37 weeks on even on Court TV with nothing else to do since you can hardly ever get a camera in a courtroom anymore. But anyway, so you can go back and watch all of that, and you can see some of these things playing out if you're so inclined. Number five on our list, one of my favorite stand-up comedians of all time was also, and this is going to be the lighthearted moment, this is the outlier number in our top 10 list. Norm MacDonald got fired from Saturday Night Live because he would not stop making jokes about O.J. Simpson.
Oh, no.
Don Ohlmeyer was the president of NBC's West Coast division. Mm-hmm. And now this is a couple of years after O.J. is found innocent in October of 1995. Mm-hmm. But for the next 3 years, every night on Saturday Night Live, Norm MacDonald was mm-hmm. the host of Weekend Update. And if you know Saturday Night Live, you know that that's the best part of the whole damn show anyway.
I remember his jokes about OJ.
Every week. And it would always start out looking like something completely innocuous. It would be something about, you know, a new Coca-Cola flavor. And then he would twist it at the end. It would be, you know, at least he didn't kill his wife and her friend whatever it is.
I know there was one joke where they, you know, at the end, OJ says he was going to, you know, spend the rest of his life trying to find her killer.
Right.
And then they cut to a picture of him on the golf course. And he's like, he's going to look on every golf course
right
across the globe.
That.
You know, stuff
well,
like that.
It's funny you said that because one of the reasons why Don Ohlmeyer wanted Norm MacDonald fired was because he was a golfing buddy of OJ Simpson's. And the criminal trial had been adjudicated.
It was over.
And he's like, hey, man, let it go. And Norm would not. To his own detriment, it turned out. So in 1998, Norm got fired. And the reason that jumped onto my radar was because there was I found this link on Facebook last week, apropos of absolutely nothing. You guys remember Cracked Magazine from when we were kids? It was like Mad Magazine, but it was another humorous magazine. Doesn't matter. Now they don't have a magazine anymore. They have a website. And so what they do is they generate lists of, in this case, the best ever Saturday Night Live Weekend Update anchors.
Okay.
And Norm MacDonald was number one on the list.
I agree.
I went down the whole list. Me too. Maybe Dennis Miller would be, I might have a little bit of an argument there, but Norm's in the top two for sure. Mm. So that got me to thinking, oh yeah, I think Norm got fired because he wouldn't stop making the OJ jokes. And so I did a little bit of research and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And you can go on YouTube and see all of, they've got them all
I suddenly
right
love
behind each other.
Norm
bang,
MacDonald.
Bang, 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 bang.
I certainly love him even more.
Well, bless his heart, he passed away in September at the age of 61.
May he rest in peace.
May he, because he was always one of my favorites. Anyway, that was another thing on the list. And so now we're into the top four, and we're moving along as the case progresses.
Okay.
There are two things that you could pin several of these, but I think two things that should have been a triumph for the prosecution that both of these items blew up in their face.
Oh.
And of course, the first one is the glove.
Oh, oof. Yeah, I remember the glove.
They were not supposed to ask OJ. The prosecution was not going to bring up putting on the glove.
Oh.
Because it's a tight-fitting glove anyway. The thing is, the gloves are 4 years old at this point. They'd been bought by Nicole Brown Simpson at Bloomingdale's or Macy's in New York City in 1990, they actually found the credit card receipt. So they know that she bought the gloves.
Okay.
But this is 4 years later. They've been subjected to all sorts of tests. There's liquid that has been applied. Snippets of them have been cut away for lab testing. Mm-hmm. And OJ's going to have to wear rubber gloves underneath the actual gloves if he's going to try them on. And everybody knows this. On both sides. So there's no way the prosecution is going to ask OJ to try on these gloves in front of everybody. Mm-hmm. Well, Christopher Darden, as he was wont to do, I discovered from reading Jeffrey Toobin's book, he gets a little emotional and speaks before he thinks sometimes. And so this was one of those instances where before Chris Darden thought about what he was doing, he said, hey, let's get OJ to try the gloves on in front of the jury, in front of the judge. And Effley Bailey is going, yes, mm-hmm. let's do this. Because they all know they're not going to fit. Mm-mm. Because one of the things that happens when they go to visit OJ in jail is a jail handshake is I put my hand up on one side of the glass. You put your hand up on the other side of the glass. That's a jail handshake. That's mm-hmm. just saying, hey, how you doing? So all of these defense attorneys know that OJ has huge ass hands. Mm-hmm. And they all go try on those gloves that day before this happens. And they go, boy, these are never going to fit on OJ's hands. And then Darden says, hey, let's get OJ to try on the gloves. So that goes horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
And then one of the other things that went horribly wrong was, of course, the Furman tapes. And now we're up to number three, one of the other big momentum shifts in the case. It turns out that Mark Furman, who was one of the detectives who went to OJ's house on the night of the murders, at the time, ostensibly to inform him that his wife had been killed and that he needed to come to her condominium and pick up his children. They realize that he's not there. They can't get in. So Furman hops over the fence, opens the gate so the other detectives can get in. In the process of looking around, they see the blood on the Ford Bronco's door. They look inside the Ford Bronco. They see blood on the console. And to hear Detective Van Adder of the LAPD say it later, we were worried that we were dealing with another crime scene. We thought maybe they had both been injured in some sort of attack. So we went onto the property. That's when Mark Furman finds the bloody glove behind Cato Kalin's guest house. Mm-hmm. They find some blood in the courtyard leading up to the stairs. They find bloody socks in OJ's bedroom. Turns out later, all this blood matches OJ Simpson. Mm. And some of it matches Ron Goldman and some of it matches Nicole Brown.
Well, when you stab people and you cut their throats, you sometimes injure yourself.
Bingo.
In the process. I don't want to get too graphic, but
yeah.
Especially if they're fighting back.
Yeah, yes. If they're fighting
especially
back.
Especially if you know Taekwondo and you're fighting back.
Well, and when you stab, guess what? There's a lot of blood.
Yes.
And the knife gets wet and your hand slips. And,
correct.
You know, I don't know why I know this, but
I don't either. Try not to end up on this podcast.
It's very messy.
We pull no punches here.
All right. It's very messy.
Yeah.
And so that makes sense.
Well, it turned out that Mark Furman is a racist piece of shit. Yeah. And at one point, I don't know how Effley Bailey already knew this, but he asked him in open court, are you telling me right now? I'm going to refer to it as the N-word.
Right.
But Effley Bailey asks Mark Furman, can you guarantee me, can you tell this jury with 100% certainty that you have never said the N-word at any time in the last 10 years? And Mark Furman says, yes, sir, I can say that I have never done that. Well, the bad news is that beginning about 7 years, 8 years earlier than that, Mark Furman met this woman, and I did not write her name down. It doesn't matter. She was a screenwriter in L.A. at the time. And they got to talking in a coffee shop one day, and he admitted that he was an LAPD officer. She told him that she was working on a screenplay about the LAPD. Mm-hmm. A series of interviews begins between these two over the course of several years. I think there are 12 tapes of 1 hour each. And over the course of these tapes, Mark Furman explains to her what it's like to be an LAPD officer, at least in his estimation. And he uses the N-word, I think, 44 times.
Oh, gracious. Wow.
He describes how they manufacture evidence against black people.
Ooh.
To get them convicted, to get them hauled off, and how certain parts of town, you can't go there anymore because, yeah.
Wow.
That kind of shit.
Wow.
And these tapes have existed for all of this time, and the lady who made the tapes decides that she is going to reach out to the defense through her attorney and make these tapes.
And make some money.
Well, that was what the, it's funny you said that because that's what the attorney wanted. That's what the attorney suggested that she do. She wanted the tapes to be used in the case. Mm-hmm. She felt like, at least to hear Jeffrey Toobin explain it in his book, she wanted justice served. She wanted to see that all the facts came out about who this guy was.
Well, hopefully that was really her intent.
She probably got some money at some
point. Probably got paid for it. Pretty well, because that is a, you've definitely, what you've done there is that has absolutely nothing to do with this particular case.
Well,
but
I agree.
These attorneys were like, heck yeah. And they were going to use it to create all kinds of smoke and mirrors. Yeah.
Johnny Cochran called it manna from heaven.
I bet.
He said,
I bet he did.
And Barry Scheck, the DNA expert, said, we might actually get him acquitted based on this.
On that evidence. Right there.
That right mm-hmm. there. And so there was this big back and forth between, they had special hearings about it. Katie, you may have to jump in here, but they had several hearings to determine how much of those tapes could be played in front of the jury. And Ito only allowed at the end two sentences.
Okay. Mm.
From that entire 12 or 24 hours, whatever it was.
Yeah, because it really didn't have anything to do with this case.
It really shouldn't. It should have any of them been allowed, Katie?
I guess it depends on what they were going for. But yeah, that makes sense why not a lot was allowed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, both of the excerpts, and you can look them up yourself.
I guess to prove he's a liar.
Okay. Because he says, I didn't say the N-word in the last 10 years, and they allowed two episodes in the tapes where he used the N-word.
Well, and that he is a liar for that. And then, but also, you have a man in detail on these tapes describing how they manufacture evidence.
Yeah, a police officer.
And he's
the guy who found the glove.
And he's been in the property. That's what I was going to say. To me, that is, you want to establish he's a liar, but you also want to say, this guy talks about planting evidence against African-American people. That's what they want to bring in. And that's that to me.
Yeah. And another thing that it didn't come out in the tapes, it came out later from Furman and some other sources, but Furman really had a problem if you were part of an interracial couple. And if you don't know out there somewhere, Nicole Brown Simpson, white, OJ Simpson, black.
Yeah.
So Furman, that was not his thing. He didn't.
Okay, so what else did they do to Furman besides call him a liar out in court? Did they bring anything? What else was the other sentence that Ito allowed?
I don't have them both written down, but basically they were very short sentences. The N-word was used both times.
Both times, okay.
And so that happened on September the 5th, 1995. This court case is 1 month from being over at this point. It ends in October.
So that stuck in the jury's mind.
That happened on the 5th. On the 6th, they had Furman. The defense called Furman back onto the stand, not in front of the jury. They had Ito sent the jury back to their room, and he had Furman come out, and they started asking him about these tapes, and Furman repeatedly took the 5th, refused to say anything, which basically killed the prosecution's case at that point.
So why was the jury not there?
Because they didn't know what Furman was going to say. And then there was going to be a determination made later.
If it would be admissible as evidence.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
Ito decided at the end not to even let the jury know that Furman came back in and played the 5th.
Yeah.
They just let him hear the tapes.
You can't unring a bell, as they
that's
say
it.
In court.
Yeah. That's it. That's exactly one of the phrases that you'll hear or read in the book. So.
Okay. So, all right. Gotcha.
Yeah. All right. So now we're down to the last two. We've got two things left.
Okay.
Just two. And number two is, and I thought this was heartbreaking, really. Nicole Brown knew how she was going to die. She was afraid that she knew how she was going to die because after she passed away, they pulled her safe deposit box. And inside her safe deposit box, they found her last will and testament, some letters that OJ had written to her after he'd been abusive to her, mm-hmm. and photos of her with bruises on her face and body. And her sister at one point said in a television interview that I saw, Nicole always said, he's going to kill me and then he's going to get away with it.
Well, and you can listen, you can pull them up if you want to. They're pretty heartbreaking. You can hear 911 calls that she made.
Yeah.
And you can hear him in the background.
Yeah.
Raising hell, just yelling, screaming at her.
There's one where you can hear physical contact.
You can.
Yeah.
And the 911 operators, and she's like, you know who I am. I've called you before. Yeah. It's Nicole.
He's beating the shit out of me.
Yep. It's
He's
happening.
He's about to beat
it's,
the shit
it's
out of
happening
me.
Again. And then the 911 operator, who is a woman, asks her, what did you do to make him mad?
No.
It's infuriating. Yeah. It's absolutely. And you can hear him in the background. It disgusts me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
That what. And you know, if there's any,
he's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, it changed the way that a lot of people treated domestic violence Mm-hmm. It was a watershed moment. And we've still got a long way to go, in my opinion, but a watershed moment in the way that domestic violence was looked
at. Too late for Nicole.
Too late for Nicole and Ron. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody forgets about Ron, but yeah.
Yeah. And that's
another life was lost.
That's another thing. That's not on the list, but a lot of people forget that it's not just OJ's ex-wife. It was also this innocent guy. As far as we know, he was a waiter in the restaurant where they had dined earlier that night, Nicole and her family without OJ after a dance recital that their 8-year-old daughter, Sydney, had been involved in. But then Nicole's mother left her glasses. And so Ron was returning, and they found an envelope laying on the ground with a pair of glasses in it to bolster that story, returning the glasses that Nicole's mother had left at the restaurant by accident. So that gets us to number one. And here we go, guys. This is the last thing. And just in case you've forgotten, we talked about it earlier a bit. O.J. Simpson was exonerated for the murders of Nicole and Ron in the criminal trial, but the Goldman family sued him in civil court, and Simpson was found liable for their deaths and ordered to pay $19 million in damages, which he hasn't paid very much of to this day. And that damage amount climbs by 10% per year, according to California law. Today, it's over $40 million.
Nobody's going to make him pay that.
That's the thing about civil verdicts, I learned. There is no enforcement policy in place for a civil verdict.
Then why would you even award something like that if you can't enforce it?
Well, what happens is, and the way I read it, it's up to you. If you sue me for $1 million and the jury awards you the million, it's up to you to figure out some way to extract $1 million from me.
So it's on me.
Yeah, it's on you.
Wow.
Here's a piece of paper.
Crap law.
Well, let
so
me
you place liens on their homes and property. And
unless you're O.J. Simpson and you move to Florida.
Where you can't do that.
You cannot.
And I'm sure
put a lien against your house to pay for a civil judgment.
Yeah, I'm sure a member of this dream team told him to go do that.
Oh, I'm sure he got a lot of good legal advice about that. But so what happened was, and the Goldman family got a lot of blowback for this in 2007 and 2008. OJ wrote a book called If I Did It, right? Yeah. Well, the Goldmans took him to court.
Okay, good.
Because the only thing that they could do, they got a lot of blowback from this. Like, wow, you guys are greedy. You're trying to capitalize off your son's murder and Nicole's murder.
I don't either. No, I don't give a crap. These people that are saying that to them couldn't care less.
Yeah.
Well, if you think that, I don't care.
One of them was Denise Brown, Nicole's sister, who said, I can't believe that the Goldman family is trying to profit off of the death of my sister and their son.
Well,
but according to what I just told you, and according to law, the only thing that they can do to try and get some of the justification that the court has granted them is to take away his name, image, and likeness as far as publishing rights. And that's what they were eventually able to do.
Well, and I don't blame them for this. I don't blame them for this because it's the principle at this point.
Yeah. Well, and the book's a lot different than it. It's not a lot different. There's a section in the book which is exactly the 200 pages that OJ originally wrote. But then there are several preliminaries in the front of the book. The Goldmans spend 10 or 15 pages explaining how and why they did this. Mm-hmm. The ghostwriter has a segment in the book. Mm-hmm. And at the end, there's a segment that explains to you how, if you want to reach out to make donations to the Ron Goldman Foundation or the Nicole Brown Simpson Foundation. And those are foundations that deal with victims of violent crime and domestic abuse. So nobody's making any money there.
Mm-hmm.
And especially
him. Especially OJ.
Well, and even the Goldmans took, there's a certain percentage of that money that they will earn from the book over the course of its life and their lives that will be set aside because two of the other people who got a civil verdict were OJ's children. They were also part of that verdict. And I'm sure that OJ will always take care of his two children, or maybe he won't. Maybe he'll stab them in the neck.
I don't know.
I don't either. But so the Goldmans thought, hey, you know what? Let's set aside a certain percentage of the money that this book will earn over the course of its lifetime and make sure that Sydney and Justin get something.
His blatant disregard and violence towards their child did not keep them from
showing compassion to his.
To his. And that's what we need to talk about. That's amazing. And I did not know that. That's fantastic.
And they explain that in the prologue to the book. And I've got it if you guys want to read it. Maybe skip the part in the middle that OJ wrote. But I still feel like there's some insightful What is to learn about OJ?
What is his part about it? Does he say how he would have done it? What does he say?
It's sort of a fictitious account. He doesn't say, "Wow, if I'd been there, I would have done this." He just begins that chapter, and the title of that chapter is "The Night in Question," and so he just tells you what might have happened that night. And in his telling of the story, there is a friend of his, a fictitious person, he says, named Charlie.
Okay,
who is there, and he blacks out and he sees blood on his hands. And Charlie, how did this happen? OJ, let's get you in the car. We got to get you out of here. So he builds this narrative around the facts that we all know about the case to insert himself into the story, but he doesn't admit that he did it. He says, that's maybe it happened this way. I don't know. It's made up bullshit.
My eyes have just rolled out of my head.
Well,
I can't roll them enough.
Let me tell you about one other book that I read, and I'm curious to know what you guys think about this. There's a book titled OJ Simpson is Innocent and I Can Prove It.
Ooh, okay.
And I read this book over the weekend, and it's about 500 pages, and it's this private investigator from Dallas who has no connection to the family. Mm-hmm. He did all of this on his own. He spent all of his own money to get every piece of evidence that he found. And he makes a very compelling argument, in my opinion, that OJ Simpson's son from his first marriage might have been involved.
I have heard this.
His name is Jason Simpson. He is 1 month younger than me.
Okay.
He was born in April of 1970. I was born in March of 70. So at the time, he was 24 years old and had mental health issues. Had anger issues. He had attacked a former girlfriend with a knife and chopped off her hair.
Let's be very clear. OJ had anger issues too.
I don't dispute that.
Let's be very clear, though.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't want to just say,
with
the quote, mental health issues and the anger and then this and that.
Well, now, OJ had nothing to do with this book. This guy, this is all just stuff that... His last name is Dean. I can't believe I didn't write that down. Look it up, read the back cover, make up your own mind if it's something you think you want to delve into. But there's a lot of evidence, that Jason Simpson had issues pretty much his entire... He suffered from a cocaine overdose at age 14.
Good gosh. Was his blood at the scene anywhere?
They never tested his blood. The LAPD never interviewed him. They didn't have his fingerprints. Nobody, that's part of the book, is this guy, this private investigator, tries to go to Gil Garcetti, who was still the DA in LA at the time. He tries to go to the California district attorney, the state district attorney. Nobody wants this thing opened back up again, at least in his telling of the story. Hey, let's let sleeping dogs lie. We tried him. And that's one thing that blew my mind. Somebody said to him, we tried the case. OJ's not guilty. The case is closed. Now, how the fuck is a case closed if you haven't solved it?
Exactly.
It's not closed. Exactly.
That's what he was told. He was told this case is closed.
Yeah. You don't have a closed case. In civil court, it's closed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's closed in civil court.
They don't have a convicted murderer.
They do not have... Or justice has
I'm
not
as
been
flabbergasted
served.
Or a, as you guys.
Or an acquitted murderer who has confessed later on. You know, because double jeopardy is a thing, but he hasn't. Yeah. He hasn't come out and said he did it.
Anybody's going to tell you that if I did it is OJ's erstwhile confession to this murder. Although he never comes out and says, if I did it.
It's not. And
well, I'm sure he checked with somebody.
Of course he did.
To make sure that there's no way he could ever be... prosecuted for admitting to it, even if somebody ever did offer up the argument that that's entirely, in fact, what the book was.
But that's an interesting book, and I'm probably going to give that a read.
You can borrow mine.
That is that's very interesting, and it does raise the question: why not look into this? Not a close case.
Just very briefly, the story is in this particular matter that Nicole was supposed to, after that big dinner that they had at Mezzaluna, the Italian place there in Brookwood?
Brentwood.
Brookwood's in Alabama.
Yes.
In Brentwood, she was supposed to bring the family to the restaurant where Jason was the chef. But for some reason, they did not show. They went to another place closer to home, Mezzaluna, instead of the place where Jason worked, which is a little bit further down the road and maybe a little bit more expensive. Anyway, plans change. You know how that happens.
Jason, the son.
Jason, OJ's son from his first marriage with Margaret.
Okay. Did they get along? Did she get along with him?
According to all indications, they got along great.
Okay.
But again, the argument in the book is Jason had rage issues. He was off his medications. He was mad because Nicole and the family didn't show up and he'd planned this special dinner for all of them that night because she had communicated she was going to bring everybody to his restaurant. Mm-hmm. And then plans changed and they didn't. Mm-hmm. So he goes over to her apartment that night to find out what happened, why they didn't show. An argument ensues. Again, this is all conjecture. We don't know this.
Yeah.
An argument ensues. He grabs one of his chef's knives. And if you know anything about being an executive chef, you always bring your own knives in a wrapped up canvas bag with you. And Jason was one of those people who took his own knives to his restaurant.
It's definitely something to check.
And then
about.
He flies off the handle. Something happens. And Jason goes and grabs OJ and says, "Hey, I've done something bad. You got to come help me." And then OJ's on the scene. And that's why his DNA evidence ends up there. And it doesn't matter if Jason's did or not, because nobody ever tested to see if it was Jason's.
Now, father-son DNA.
Got to be close, right?
Is it, would it test the son? I mean, no. I don't know anything
that
about it.
That is okay. One question that I had when I finished the book, and I was never clear on how that. Would.
I know that there's a whole thing with like paternity suits. Like if you're like father-son, like it can pop kind of close, similar. Like,
well, it would be similar, but you still got 50% of someone else's DNA in your body.
Yeah, true. But there's one section where...
Well, but it was dated
again. Yep. That's you're going where I was going. Yes. It was dated. That's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think now, today, that would be an issue.
Well, and that's another thing. This book, O.J. Simpson is Innocent and I Can Prove It, was written in the mid-2000s. Mm-hmm. So you've got another 13 years of DNA technology at this time. He couldn't even get his hands on any samples. Couldn't get anybody to pull blood from Jason Simpson to run it through the tests to see. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to hear about it.
What does Jason Simpson say about this?
Not much. I mean, there's never been a lawsuit filed against this author. Because at that point, you'd have to go to court and prove that it wasn't you, right? And that sounds, if that sounds like
has
maybe
he had
the
any
guys,
kind of response to this, or what does he do now? Where is he now?
As far as I know, he's a chef somewhere.
He's still a chef.
Yeah.
But
and he's my age, so he's 52 years old.
I mean, I know he was found innocent, and I have to keep going back to that, but does it not make more sense being the jealous, enraged, abusive
ex-husband?
Oh,
sure. Yeah.
Than the chef's.
Sure.
Stepson.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I agree with
yeah. I mean,
the premise of the book.
But I understand. And I'm probably going to read that book. It sounds
very interesting. Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
So I guess, and I am, because I've heard those 911 calls, I am very partial.
Sure.
I don't like OJ from those. He, at the very least, is abusive and threatening and a monster in that sense.
Domineering.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I can't fully say he's a murderer because he was found guilty in civil court.
That's true.
So.
Yeah.
Right. Can I say that?
He
was convicted in civil court of murder.
Yeah.
He was convicted in civil court of being responsible for their death.
So he was found innocent of murder.
Which I don't understand.
In a criminal trial.
I don't understand.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And then the fact that they're saying it's closed, they know. I mean, that's who they think did it. So they've closed it.
Right.
He was found. And so they're not looking into any other avenues, which is kind of reckless. Is that reckless? Is that the right word?
I guess it's telling in itself.
The LAPD has a long history of screwing up things.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably continues to this day. I don't know what's going on out in LA right now. If you're listening in Los Angeles and the DA's office has fucked it up again, drop us an email and let us know. We'd love to tell everybody about it.
Well, and you can get all kinds of shirts and merch and everything anywhere that simply says OJ did it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know what? Maybe we should make some of those.
I'm not going to make any.
Well, our other shirts aren't really going like hotcakes. Maybe if we had an OJ shirt, we could move some merch.
There are a lot of true crime podcasts and things that have merch that reference OJ. And
I think that's
people
an avenue that we should explore.
People that are not true crime podcasters who have merch that's things like that. So.
Yeah.
Where is OJ today?
Well,
Scott?
OJ, it's funny, on the very same day that If I Did It hit newsstands.
Okay.
Maybe not the same day, but around that same time. That was the day in 2008 when OJ broke into a a Las Vegas hotel room to reacquire some merchandise that he said was his.
Okay.
Long story short, he gets accused of kidnapping and wielding a firearm, and he's convicted of several charges mm-hmm. and sentenced to 33 years in jail. He didn't get out of jail until, I want to say, 2018, 2019. He spent 10 or 12 years in jail in Vegas or in Nevada.
He was sentenced for this scheme. How many?
He was sentenced to 33 years in 2008 or 9. Okay. And he got out about 10 or 11 years later. And as far as I know right now, he is living in Florida. He's 74 years old in whatever house he can't have taken away from him because Florida is a homestead state. Mm-hmm. So you can't be forced to pay off a legal judgment.
So the Goldmans can't touch him there, basically.
They can't touch the house.
His stuff.
Yeah.
His stuff there.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, he served 9 years.
Okay. Yeah, 17 from 8 to 17 or 9 to 18,
what did
whatever.
He steal?
His own memorabilia. It was a lot of stuff that he'd had in a storage building somewhere that I read. Football related jerseys and trophies and maybe some signed
items.
And
why did this place have it?
It's a little bit cloudy why this guy was some collector who somehow had acquired a bunch of his stuff. Mm-hmm. And OJ's contention was that it was stolen from him from a storage building that he was hiding it so that the Goldmans, I guess, couldn't get their hands on it.
Oh, but yeah. But then he's charged with kidnapping and armed robbery. So,
who did he kidnap?
Like, when they went into the hotel room, I think he made somebody leave the hotel room with him to, like, hey, you're coming with me.
Yeah,
to go get my stuff.
Yep, that's it. That'll do it.
So that. Mm-hmm. And somebody recorded whoever the guy was, he had a tape recorder sitting on top of an entertainment center, recorded the entire thing audio and used that in court, and that helped get him convicted.
Mm. Yeah, and then he gets out in 2017 and he's on parole, and I just looked it up, and of 2021, he was released early from parole too. Like, he is a completely free man. He's not even out on parole.
Mm-hmm. So.
So he's done his time. He paid his debt to society.
Man, that's a lot of work to.
And it's over.
Yeah.
And so he's just retired in Florida.
Until he dies and goes to hell, if you believe in that.
Well.
Because that's where he's headed.
Mm.
If he killed two people. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean.
If you're into that, that's where he's headed.
I'm just saying that the recorded. Okay, so all that was recorded. Let me go back to recordings.
Sure.
Were any of the 911 recordings that I have heard allowed in court? Did Ito allow any of that?
I think the one from 1989, which is when she called, and that's the one that he should have gone to jail for, mm-hmm. that he was supposed to be arrested for. And that's when the cop said, OJ, sorry, it looks like she's got bruises on her. She's called us. You've got to go to jail now. But you're in your bathrobe, so we're going to let you go upstairs and change clothes, and we'll meet you back at the front door in 5 minutes. Well, OJ goes upstairs and changes clothes and hops into his car, his Bentley, and escapes from Rockingham, and he does not go to jail. He ends up convicted of abuse, and he has to do 120 hours of community service and pay a $500 fine, the standard stuff. But he did the same thing in 94, if you think about it. When he was about to get arrested, he thought, well, hell, I'll just leave like I did last time. I'll hop in the car with AC and we'll take off.
Interesting.
And maybe I'll get away with it again. Yeah. I think that it worked once. Why not try it again? And the LAPD loved celebrities. They do to this day. They treat celebrities differently. There's this famous story about when John Belushi died in 1982 from a drug overdose at a hotel in the LA area. The LAPD screwed up and his family found out about his death before they got a chance to tell them. And so there was this thing in the LAPD at the time, let's don't let another Belushi happen. So that was why Van Adder and Lang and Furman and the other detective loaded up at 4 a.m. and went over to Rockingham to tell OJ about his dead wife before he found out about it in the news. That was their argument about why they were there at that early hour in the morning and ended up finding the glove and climbing over the fence. But the LAPD tries to use kid gloves on celebrities. OJ had a lot of friends on the police force. Mm-hmm. The gun that he held to his head while they were riding in the Bronco on the slow speed car chase had been purchased for him by a member of the LAPD 3 years before.
Wow. And why would
because they were his buddies. They hung out with him. They came over to his house and used his pool and used his tennis court when they were off duty. He had off duty cops do security for events at his house.
And they still proved that they were out to get him.
That was what the defense attorneys.
Wow.
Yeah. They're so incompetent that they can't gather blood evidence at a crime scene. But at the same time, they're so sophisticated that it was this elaborate scheme to frame another black man who dates a white woman.
And on top of that, they're also his friends.
And they're also his friends.
Wow.
Where are they?
Wow.
Yeah. I hope when OJ gets to where he's going, I hope he saves a seat for Johnny Cochran and Bob Shapiro and F. Lee Bailey.
Johnny Cochran's.
And Alan Dershowitz, because they'll, well, then I know where they went.
Oh, wow.
I'm not going to speculate on any of that today, Scott, but you are correct in being disgusted by this whole thing.
And
this
I'm so glad. I told you before we started today, my first thing was let's make this a 2 or 3 part series. Mm-hmm. I think I would have to have a vomit bag on my person at all time. Mm-hmm. If I had to talk about this for another 5 minutes, I'm done.
You need to go shower off the taint.
I'd be better off rolling in the dirt. I'd feel cleaner than I do right now.
Well, those were very interesting. There was a lot of stuff there that I had forgotten. Some stuff that I never knew. So thank you, Scott. We're educated a little more on that whole situation.
And as am I. And now I can hit the button and evacuate all of that crap from my brain. I never have to think about it again.
But I do like that approach. And I think that was a very interesting way to go back and tell the story. And
agreed.
I liked it.
I picked this turd. It was my job to polish it.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. You did an excellent job today, turd polishing. You're a professional turd polisher.
Professional.
I would have to be.
You are. Yep.
All right. Is that it? Are we done? Anything
That's
else?
It. Just visit our website,
TrueCrimeOnEasyStreet.com. Don't forget to give us a 5-star review. Let me handle this, Kelly.
I never remember our website.
And you can find us on social media. All the social media is True Crime on Easy Street.
Yep.
On Easy Street, not at. I don't know why I keep saying at. Sorry.
Yeah, stop it. You did
True
it again.
TrueCrimeOnEasyStreet.com.
gmail.com if you're trying to get the email.
Oh, you can say at gmail.com. Yeah.
All right. That's it. This is off in the ditch.
Off the rails.
We was fine until the very end and we've run it off in the ditch.
So sorry, everybody.
Good night, everybody.